make a hearing.
Morning, Ms. Hall.
Good morning. Firstly, I haven't prepared any summary or a summary of what evidence given the short nature of it. I thought it was enough. Secondly, a large apology to Amanda for the spelling of her surname. I've always already been growled, but I will put that on record, please. My evidence today is confined to the ability for community activities to be located and anticipated within the medium intensity zone. And I believe that the matters of discretion can capture the adverse effects of an inappropriate community activity being applied for within the proposed medium density zone. So that's in essence what I'm here to discuss today, and I'm happy for any questions or further expansion of that.
Just a quick clarification question from the council, not you, Ms. Hutton. My agenda list for submitter is 408, but the evidence has it as 430. Can I just have the correct submitter reference for my bookkeeping? Maybe that's something that can come, not necessarily right now, but we can just sort that out.
Sure,
that's
408.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our documents electronically have it as 430.
That's my evidence, yeah.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, it's happened, certainly a short and sweet statement.
Concise. the bulk of my evidence, I think, will be when we get to the hearing on the zone itself for the university.
Yeah.
When I actually distilled the submission made on behalf of the board, there was only this really as a matter for evidence at this time.
With the chairperson's indulgence, you were here through the last submitter's presentation.
For part thereof.
And you were seated behind Mr. Kyle in such a way that I could see you vociferously nodding or shaking at various parts.
That was taking me back to times of plane change 1935.
So you were just having a bad flashback.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, I was going to invite you as a professional planner who might help us if you had any additional advice you might give us on those technical issues while you're here, but if it was just flashbacks.
It was more flashbacks, but I'm happy to try and assist if I can. But it was more how we discussed sort of those issues of reverse sensitivity and the like around Plan Change 19 in the area of land so close to the airport that wasn't within, say, the outer control boundary, where that was. And that discussion that you had about, well, live in a noisy environment or go and live in Glen Orchy, what's the balance? I just found this interesting from a planning perspective anyway.
Okay, well, if there's nothing burning you felt you had to express to us, we can just move on from it. In terms of your actual client and why you're here, look, I don't have any questions, thanks. It's pretty clear.
Do you have any questions? I'm still digging into it here.
Okay, well, I just
a couple.
Yes.
Just in terms, in your paragraph 3.4, you've set out what the potential effects community activities you see.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think they should have different height provisions? Is that what you're suggesting? Mm. From the zone standards?
I don't necessarily, for the board, in terms of the church, we had looked at a higher height limit for a spire, which is part of it, but it was more if you were going for a discretionary activity for an activity, say, such as a church, as an example, that one of the matters of discretion for the community activity component of it might be the height of the building and potentially the need for that. The church would be a spire, potentially a fire station would be the post-drying apparatus, which I can't remember what it's called, so just another...
drying tower.
Yeah, another matter of discretion.
So it was just for those specific sort of things, it wasn't for the individuals, so it'd be the one-off instances, if you like.
No.
Okay. And what sort of reverse sensitivity effects are you referring to there to have discretion over?
It's always an interesting discussion. I guess we, in the 42A report and Ms. Leith's summary, talk about the wide nature of the activities that come under the ambit of the definition of community activity, which could be for schools, hospitals, right down to courthouses, probation and detention centres. So reverse sensitivity could be something that a planner could look at in terms of if one of those sort of more sensitive from a medium density environment perspective, say a probation centre, something I'd look at if a consent came in, if I was on the council side, would be where is the location of the mingling area, the outside area, is that close to an adjacent residence, or can we move it out of the way so it's not making or creating any reverse sensitivity type matters. The other thing, I guess, where we are in this zone in Frankton, it is a greenfield zone at start, so there is the anybody doing a medium density residential development in there would see that community activities and that list of available activities are as proposed discretionary, or in my evidence as restricted discretionary, and can occur there. So you'd be looking at that sort of list of type of activities anticipated.
Aren't the effects you've described, though, the actual effects of the activity?
Probably, yes.
And that's the residential activities that potentially might have reverse sensitivity effects, so the residential activities are permitted. Isn't that what you are? So it's a sort of okay. The other question I had is, in terms of restricted discretionary activity approach, don't you generally apply, in a planning sense, an RDA on the basis that pretty much anywhere in the zone is appropriate because it's the particular instances of that, of how it's going to be done? Nodding in agreement. Does that mean, therefore, that community activities on your assessment are appropriate on every site in the zone?
I understand your question in light of the need for providing land for medium density zoning, because that is very important and that is the need. But
No, that's not the point of the question. The point is that I'm wondering is whether the activities are discrete.
Yeah.
And therefore, there will be some sites within the zone which will be appropriate for them because of size, location,
yes,
but not every site. And whether RDA is actually the appropriate way to go with that, as opposed to full discretionary activity.
I think the second bullet point, the location, nature and scale and frequency of activities could help capture any concern about the ability of and community activity on a specific site and its appropriateness.
I suppose the other way of asking it, when I look at the list there from A to G in paragraph 3.4, what haven't we covered? Because if we haven't if there is isn't anything that we haven't covered, then we're not restricting the discretion, are we? Because everything is in reality up for grabs. The purpose of a restrictive discretion is so that council is limited to what it looks at, but
yes.
There seems to be very little there that isn't.
I think it, given the restricted discretionary and category for the for a community activity, also gives a bit of a premise that that sort of activity is anticipated and provided for as long as those matters are dealt with appropriately.
Paragraph 3.9, you're saying there the combination of requiring restricted discretionary activity consent for the activity and then non-complying consent for the bulk of location breaches. Deals with those issues and makes it fit in. Would your opinion remain the same if those non-compliance as both the location would change to restricted discretionary?
I believe that if the change for bulk and location breaches were restricted discretionary, which it isn't usual, I guess, in the district planning for residential areas, that overheight building would be classed at restricted discretionary as opposed to not complying. But if that was the case, for community activities, there probably would be, depending on the nature of the discretion that is restricted, enough ability to get a good outcome within that residential environment. It's not something that I'd...
I wasn't thinking of height, I was thinking more of height to boundary and recession planes, setbacks.
Yeah.
But those are generally RDAs.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. No, I was thinking more if you're going for another story or something as restricted discretionary without having it.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a simple general question? Is the trust looking to go out there primarily for housing or to get a new church?
Primarily to erect a new church. Yeah, they'll be lodging resource consent soon. Church, and as I understand it, in the first instance, stage one will be for a church and for manse to support the church and for the members of the church to actually have somewhere to live in Antrim, because they're having the same issues as everybody else with affordability of housing for staff.
Okay. And just to follow up on that one, it's to do with size, not with noise. You're currently within the out of control boundary, this environment.
Yes, yeah. It is primarily to do with size and the ability to have some more green space around the church for children's play areas, discussions after church, sort of amenity type issues, yeah. I understand they feel they've outgrown that area where they are now in Franklin.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Allen. Awesome.
Chairman, Commissioners, come back to gnaw away again on the bone of gnawed on before in the rural zone relating to the definition of residential flat. I have previously disclosed to the panel that Arcadian Tribe Limited is my company and essentially a vehicle for me to come along and express some views. It doesn't actually affect Arcadian or Arcadians. I'd like to start by referring you to your medium density S42A report, dated 14 September, on page 22, or paragraph 9.31, which has an interesting quote from your community plan independent hearings panel. I'll read it out. The panel considers that controls on the internal aspects of buildings under the RMA, to the extent that they are appropriate at all, cannot exceed the requirement for such controls set by the building code. Unitary plan can control location of building on a site, overall height, address adverse effects of location or height on the environment, should not be controlled in the manner in which a building is constructed. This type of control addresses the function of the building rather than its effects on the environment around it, and it's not appropriate to be included in a district plan, which is concerned with the land use plan. I just like you to just, the point I'm addressing is not addressed where that quote is, but just like you to hold that quote in your mind about controls which address land use planning under the RMA, because I think it has some relevance. A short bit of history which is actually relevant to my submission. Prior to 1995, there was no right for residential flat under the Transitional District Plan. 1995, which was the year that the ODP was notified. It's my last year as chairman of the planning committee. I happened to go to Whistler in Canada, who had been facing issues of sensitive landscapes and affordable housing for 20 years. One of the little devices they had to help with housing and things was the right to build a residential flat in every house. I brought that idea back to Queensland and stuck it in the district plan, and we've had that's been in there since 1995. Now, I've handed round the definition of residential flat. It is not quite the same as it was in 1995. It's fairly close, but in particular, there's a fifth bullet point there which says does not cover more than 35% of the total gross floor area of the building. Now, at some point in the late 90s, when that limitation was not in the definition, somebody came up with a bright idea of building a duplex, two identical units with identical garages, and calling one of them a residential flat, thereby getting effectively two identical units on one site under the definition. I remember it was his lawyer. And I think that was done once or twice.
It did occur to me that it would have been one of your applications.
he actually figured it out himself and came to me to ask me if you found the loophole. I had to say, yeah. The council reacted almost light speed, introduced a plan change, and it introduced that 35% total gross floor area limitation. Between the original insertion of this rule and even with that tweak, one of the side effects of this was that it legalised numerous residential flats that had been built all over the district without getting resource consent. There was just every second house in the place in them a residential flat, and they were all virtually all legalised by this change in the rules. And now we have another change, and I've previously argued, and I'm still arguing, for the 35%. I'm not too worried about the other little twins to the rule. dealt with in your 42-hour report. But my solution to you is that the 35% of total gross floor area, with or without the garage, I don't really care about that, is a method which has been working for at least 15 years, and my submission should be reinstated and should continue. If I look at Calvin Heights, an 850 square metre lot in Calvin Heights, fairly normal, 40% site coverage, allows 240 square metres of ground floor building, 340 square metres of ground floor building, two floors under the 7 or 8 metre height plane, 680 square metres of house. It's quite a big house. There are some houses in Calvin Heights which aren't too far away from that. There's some big houses over there. Now, if someone has a section that they can build a 680 square metre house on, and they want to put in a residential flat for their parents or their kids and their grandkids or visitors, where is the RMA justification for saying to that person, you can have a 70 square metre flat, but not a 71 square metre flat, without getting a resource consent? Where's the RMA rationale for saying to that? Because in reality, 70 square metres, you can do a two-bedroom flat, you couldn't swing a cat in the bedrooms. It's pretty constrained, you know. Lake Hayes Estate, probably about right. Calvin Heights, if someone who's wealthier and wants to build a bigger residential flat, where's the RMA justification for 70 square metres? So I asked myself to look at the S42A report for the justification. And it can be found on page, I'm looking at the low density report, page 63, paragraph 14.23. I'll just read it. The S32 report identifies a number of issues with the ODP definition of residential flats, stating that it enables the construction of very large residential flats were associated with a large dwelling, and has encouraged the construction of oversized garages to enable a large floor area for a flat. That's the section 32 justification for this change. I'll read it again. It enables the construction of very large residential flats were associated with a large dwelling. Question. Adverse environmental effects? Not identified. And has encouraged the construction of oversized garages to enable a large floor area for a flat. Well, if you want to construct a large garage for your two SUVs and your jet ski, you can put bedrooms on top of it. That's all right. But if you want to put bedrooms in the kitchen and the bathroom, you've got to go through a resource consent process. So I say, my suspicion is, looking at the S42A report, I don't see the RMA-based justification for this unnecessary control that what a landowner can do with their house. I then thought to dig a bit further back, and to save you looking for one further handout from handouts.
Lasted more than 10 minutes. No, okay. Well, you know, practice doing this beforehand so you can time yourself.
There's a Queenstown Low Density Residential Zone Monitoring Report in 2011, and I discovered the one problem that was identified with residential flats, which was the inclusion of residential flats in multi-unit developments enabling a clustering of high density in excess of that which is envisaged. That's the only problem identified. That problem was not addressed in this plan review. It could have been for the limitation on residential flats and multi-unit dwellings, but it wasn't addressed. And it's not a problem which is addressed by this change. I look at, and I want to put a little scenario to you, because I've been thinking about loopholes, and I have clients asking me about containers and modular building. I buy a low density residential section, 600 square metres, new density going down to 300 per residential unit, up to 5.5 in height. I buy 8 40 foot containers, and the big ones, the short ones, 20 foot and 40 foot. A 40 foot container has about 30 square metres floor space. Put them in fours, two on top and two on bottom, and two on top and two on bottom. I've got and call the top floor a residential unit and the bottom floor a residential flat. I've got four identical units on a 600 square metre section. Don't know if it's economically viable, don't know whether you do it, given the value of land, but I'm just identifying that if you go to the bottom level of the range, you're back where we were before we made the change with the 35%. I note the definition, the new definition of residential flat, which is in your amended provisions, a residential activity that comprises a self-contained flat that is ancillary to a residential unit. If you're 35%, house is twice as big, flat's half as big at the most, it's obviously ancillary. But if you change the rules whereby you can put you can build a 70 square metre unit and a 70 square metre flat side by side in a multi-unit development, which is the problem I identified back in 2011, you're back to where we started from. Final comment, I'm a lawyer, I act for purchasers. In 15 years' time, someone's going to come along and buy a house with a residential flat in it. They're going to get their lawyers to do due diligence. The lawyer's going to say, oh, 70 square metres. Is it 70 square metres? Oh, no, it's better than that. Right, is it legal? Then you start diving back into the limb and you find out it hasn't got a resource consent. Then you've got to go back 15 years and find out what the planning rules were back 15 years ago. And you may eventually discover that the residential flat, when it was built, a third the size of the house was legal. And therefore, even though it doesn't comply with the new rule, it's got an existing use right. That's $1,500 worth of investigation on compliance. Because the rules change. I say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. 35% makes sense. It rises and falls with the size of the house. Expensive, big flat, Lake has a state, little flat, Bridesdale, probably can't do it. It kind of makes sense. It works. No identified problems. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's fine. That's it.
Yes, so thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. I just want to ask you, thank you for retelling us the investigation you've gone through.
I wasn't sure what I had before, I'm sorry.
The original submission has some specific commentary. We've now got a 42A recommendation. I'm looking at the Chapter 7 identity recommendations that, as Appendix 1 to that report, has a marked up version.
Okay.
What do you actually want? You just want the 70 square metres replaced with 35%?
Yeah, the first bullet. I mean, I came on the rural general zone here and got sent about up to 150. But it's the first bullet point. I also submitted for that last little change, which has been accepted, cutting out labour use for the party and the advice note, which has been accepted. Just the first bullet point.
So, one of the comments you made was, what's the resource management basis for 70? Why not 71? Well, why 35%? Why not 36?
Except it was arbitrary at the time, but it was addressing an issue, and it ended up being a flexible rule that worked on all sizes, and kind of sniff test, residual flats are really more than half the size of the house, so it kind of made sense. I can't say there's any science behind it. I would say there's more intuitive rationale behind it than there is behind 70 square metres.
Do you agree with or accept the distinction between a residential flat, whatever its requirements are, and a second independent household unit? What do you see as the differences?
Time to make the definition, they're on the same title, they're into the same ownership, and they're part of the same building. Apart from that,
are they part of the same building?
No. Sorry, here's my definition.
Well, that's why I'm asking you, what do you actually want? I'm looking at the 42A. It says ancillary. Right. Self-contained doesn't mean attached to the house. Last bullet says on the same site, held in the same ownership. Doesn't seem to say to me that it has to be in the same building.
I accept that. I hadn't realised, going back to my original definition, is contained within the same residential.
So are you asking for that too?
I would certainly support that.
Right.
I would certainly support that. I have no problem with that at all.
Because I can understand the 35% floor area relationship having some sense if it was part of the same building. But if it was a separate building, I was scratching my head saying, if it complies with all the relevant controls, who cares if it's 70 metres or 71 or 35 or 36 or whatever.
I entirely accept that.
Okay.
Part of the same building, connected, so the flat is part of the same overall, even if it's rented out.
Yeah. You mentioned in your discussion at one point two bedrooms. Is that...
Which side?
You mentioned when you were talking about family flats you've come across and you said you talked about two bedrooms. Is that something that's relevant to the difference between a residential flat and a separate house? Is the putting aside... No. So...
I mean, we have a home residential flat that has one bedroom.
Yeah.
And then a lounge where you can actually pull the mattress out. It kind of suits the occasional visitor. Doesn't suit my son and my daughter at home at the same time. Doesn't suit them. So... Yeah.
Are you aware of any three-bedroom or four-bedroom residential flats?
Not personally.
So would an alternative to either 70 metres or 35% just be two bedrooms? Or maximum of two bedrooms? Which might give all the flexibility you're talking about, but still be clearly different to a separate house that someone might want to subdivide off.
I don't know that really
about that. Okay, look, thanks, Mr.
I have any questions?
Thank you. How were the concerts, by the way?
Unbelievable.
You've overcome the subsequent deafness?
Yes. Concerts on three consecutive days is getting beyond me by age. The worst of course, all the performers would have been 73 and 76, so they make you feel a bit bad.
Yes.
I have some speaking notes prepared, but I'm also very aware that you've read everything to date and you may wish to go straight to questions. I've also got Mr. McIntosh here with me today. You've heard from him before. He hasn't got written evidence on this topic, but my evidence does rely on his earlier evidence, and he's available for any questions you may have today.
I'm happy to go straight to questions. If you have a question on that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
That being said, there was nothing I didn't understand in the presumed way of evidence.
The only questions I had were paragraph 5.6, you've suggested some objectives and policies. Would it be appropriate, do you think, to give some sort of indication of the location preferences in the policies? I mean, surely they're not appropriate in every location.
Yes, and the objectives and policies that I've repeated there come from a memorandum of council in response to questions from the panel of Chapter 3 some time ago. And the draft policies there have sought to encapsulate some level of locational preference by reference to urban areas as opposed to rural. And it was Mr. McIntosh's evidence that the fire service has a way of determining the location of fire stations, and it's likely to be that any new fire station would be in an urban area.
I recall we had that discussion. I think it was in the strategic directions.
Yes, that's right.
Stream, and it's unsurprising because that's where most of the demand for their service will be.
Exactly, and the way in which stations are located is very much calculated on the the turnout time and the ability to respond to a fire within a certain time. That's indicated to the government every year, I believe.
I think the point that I was wondering was rather more fine-grained than that. Within the urban area, there are a whole range of locations. And if we're to be providing for emergency services to go in there with some form of consent obviously required, I'm wondering whether the objectives and policies might actually give some sort of indication of what are the most appropriate type forms of location within urban areas. Is it in quiet cul-de-sacs next to reserves, or is it in along main highways, or that sort of indication? I'm just trying to make it easier for someone to assess an application, given that it won't just be the fire service, but this would apply to, obviously.
Yes, well, I guess, should a rule be included that relates to emergency services, then it does confine it somewhat compared to perhaps community activities per se. In my experience, it would be unheard of for a fire station to be located in a quiet cul-de-sac because of the operational requirements for a fire station needing adequate entry and exit points. It's difficult to confine it in a policy, and I think perhaps the way in which this is sought to be achieved through the Commission's submission has been to seek the restricted discretionary activity status in the residential zone such that in an appropriate location could necessitate a consent to be declined, as opposed to perhaps a commercial or industrial zone where a permitted activity status might be more appropriate. So using the activity status is perhaps an indication of the most appropriate, as opposed to a location where certain effects still need to be adequately tested under RMA.
Okay, thank you.
Just a question regarding this question. With the fire stations, you've got six listed there. I was wondering if they're looking at Bakaroo or Kingston, right, in the district? Or?
Yes, they are, but they're not in residential zones.
And okay.
The Commission's original submission identifies precisely which stations are in which zones, but I can't recall.
Yeah.
I can.
I think the difference. We discussed that earlier. I think the rural fire service stations. I think is that the distinction? The rural in Makarua.
Oh yes, and that would be the case. So
yes.
they're not a matter that's dealt with by the commission itself.
Yes, that's why I wasn't in the rural part. So
you do have submission from the rural fire service as well.
Yes.
Yes.
The other question, just on your rule, I mean, suggested rule on the last page, I just wondered whether, and it may be a matter of definition of emergency services, whether it should be limited to public providers as opposed to anyone who puts their hands up and says we're an emergency service.
Yes, I wonder if that would confine the ambulance services a little. They're not government agencies that provide those, I think, charitable trusts, perhaps. It would require some thought. It would perhaps not be consistent with the RPS definition of emergency services, too.
Okay.
I just wonder if perhaps I should briefly, while I'm here, highlight for you the outcomes of the RPS decisions in relation to the fire service. I don't know if that's useful to you now.
I haven't looked at those particular policies, but don't worry, we're on top of the fact.
You're on top of it.
We're waiting eagerly for the, I think it was the 8th or 14th of November, which was the last day for appeals.
For appeals,
to
yes.
See what one pieces are not appealed.
Okay,
is the fire service proposing to appeal?
The fire service isn't a submitter, so no.
Well, there you go.
Yes, that said, the objectives and policies are favourable and distinct to emergency services as opposed to a more generic approach to community activities,
yes.
Which is underpins my evidence.
I think that the VRPS has become a little bit more helpful. It's just a matter of seeing what comes into effect effectively.
Yes, indeed.
Okay,
thank you for your time.
Afternoon, sir. I know that Mr. Neil McDonald was hoping to make an appearance this afternoon. He's gone home to find a tie. He might be perhaps struggling to find a cleaner, I'm not quite sure. But it was not my intention to traverse any of my primary evidence today, but to answer questions to it. However, I can go through it if it's necessary.
Okay, I suppose the first question that we've got is the submitter seeking that the land have the overlay removed, or is it seeking a different intensity of development from both in the overlay and the LDR?
The primary submission was to have the overlay removed, and which would essentially bring it back to a low density residential minimum lot size and density.
So the reason I asked that is,
yeah.
is it really a mapping issue?
Yeah, well that's essentially why I raised it at the start of my primary evidence, whether there's a consideration here. I know that we got caught up in rural lifestyle zones with minimum lot size and density as the characteristics pertaining to a particular parcel of land, and,
yes.
And that in essence was why we were deferring those. So I see the quite similar characteristics, if you like, with this particular submission.
Well, it just strikes me that this is an instance where the hearing panel really needs to look at the site and consider the circumstances, which is more of a mapping issue than...
Oh, yeah, the concur, yes.
So would your client, perhaps, be happy for us to just defer this in total to the panel that hears the mapping?
Yep. I think that would be a preference.
Okay. And then if there's any, as a result of that, if any changes need to be made in the zone provisions, that's fine, because that's going to be as a result of that hearing.
Sounds good. Your afternoon is getting quicker and quicker.
Yes.
just a comment.
Yeah.
It's about basically, I guess, geotechnical stuff here, the looks of things. And so there's been an overlay put on it. When you go into the proposed high density regulations with in number 9, it's and on 9, you know, in 9.4.4, it says that where a site is subject to any natural hazard or the proposal results in an increase, etc., etc., the degree of risk the hazards pose to people and property, whether the proposal will alter the risk in any site, the extent to which the risk can be avoided or mitigated, seems to suggest that you get some expert evidence to make that decision.
That's right.
Rather than have something blanket popped on it in the plan. That's where you're coming from.
That's where I'm coming from, yes. I guess I've promoted a case study there of some more recent work that we've done where we've found generic geotechnical assessments. Generally, obviously don't have a detailed site-by-site investigation, hence why they often condition consents for pilot cuts and whatnot. And we've had cases where, like I say, a 2005 generic assessment would be superseded by a 2014 detailed site investigation to find that areas that were previously considered to be unbuildable are now buildable. I know, apart from the geological conditions, that there will also be external factors that might be influencing that, and that's pretty well explained as Section 32 is the demand for the housing, so the cost or the price people are willing to pay for development in a geotechnical constraint or an area with a geotechnical constraint is a bit more, so solutions become available.
You know, I guess we're setting up the avoid for like the Christchurch situation.
Yeah.
You know, they allow the building on the land.
Absolutely.
Liberal that someone had probably found prior to.
Yeah, well, I guess where we're coming from is, as we see it, I mean, we're not trying to circumvent that there's a geotechnical constraint there that requires further investigation, but certainly we don't think it indicates that you close the door, so to speak, to future development.
I suppose I should add that in theory we were expecting to receive a reasonably high level of evidence to the site so that the panel will have a...
I accept that too, and then I often go, well, why wouldn't we just use that as a resource consent? So, well,
The plan outcome can get you to that point, of course.
I know. But after my detailed site investigation, I might just turn around and back it anyway. Cool.
Okay.
Thank you.
Probably doing until 2 o'clock.